Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is March 7th, 2013. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. 2013 on the Soleri Report is the year of coming clean. Our coming clean poster's up on the blog. We have a new Soleri story. We're going to be putting up these little videos once a week, along with Just a Taste, which is a little brief of the Soleri Report from the following week. The one we have up this week, the new one, is about food and wealth. We got on the Soleri Report Roundup. We do a roundup 3 times a week to prepare for the Soleri Report on Thursday evenings. And the first 15 minutes turned out to be a conversation everybody on the team is juicing. We've all watched Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead. And it turns out we're all juicing, and we were trading juice recipes. It was very, very inspiring. A couple weeks ago, we did one called Detox Power with Dr. Laura Thompson. And I would encourage you to enjoy that Soleri story and check out the audio or the transcript for Dr. Laura Thompson. Our hope and our plan this year is to inspire you to invest in your health, starting with lots of healthy, fresh food. If you want to stay in a higher mind in this environment, there's nothing like lots of healthy, fresh food. Upcoming event, I'm going to be in Portland on April 24th. It's part of the Ilahi Lecture Series. It's going to be called Who Owns You? Who Owns Your Money? And What Can You Do About It? And I'm going to stay over for that Saturday and have a lunch, not at a juice bar, but a lunch in Portland, Oregon. For subscribers, you can sign up on the blog. Remember, we have the webinar software doing slides as we go along on the Soleri Report. Justin has outdone himself on the slides tonight, so I encourage you to walk along. And then, of course, you can post questions. We have the questions that you post on the blog, but you can always post them tonight as you're listening to our discussion. And our discussion tonight, very intriguing. The non-revolution in digital payments with Eric Hughes. Eric Hughes is one of the people in my life that I most enjoy talking to. He's both powerful and brilliant and a very intriguing thinker. The freedom to transact freely and privately is an integral aspect of freedom. At the heart of this question are the payment and the clearing systems that we depend on. Everything from those systems that support credit cards and bank wires to securities custodians. My goal for tonight's report is to inspire you to become conscious of the payment systems in your life and the role that they play. It's something most people don't even think about. Little events like MF Global got us started about thinking these things. We see different rumors saying the Vatican Bank has been kicked off the SWIFT system. What does that mean? But I want you to be more conscious of the fact that these systems are not private, and to inspire you to look for opportunities to create options and redundancy in your financial life rather than depend entirely on larger systems. Our theme tonight, the world moves forward. As sequester rolls out across America, not just the reality of it, but the threats and the terror and the spin and the politics of it, you see more and more people saying, you know something, we've had it with the legacy systems. How can we just begin to shift away and build new things in new ways? And so the world moves on. Money and markets, the world may be moving on, but you wonder in the global financial markets, they're moving on, but you wonder where in the world they're going. We saw the Dow this week return to and then surpass its 2007 high. The strength in the equity markets was not matched in bonds and commodities, which were reeling, particularly commodities. Morningstar, I reviewed Morningstar, all bond funds this weekend. Interestingly enough, if you look at the average returns for the last 6 months for long-term U.S. Treasury bond funds, the return was a negative 8.3%. That's devastating when you realize that it's the long Treasury bond market that holds up the entire game. It holds up the federal budget. So going into a sequester with investors literally getting hammered in the Treasury market, it's not surprising that we see gold hammered down, because a negative 8.3% in the long bonds is a neon sign flashing inflation, inflation, inflation. A great piece that I put up on the blog from John Hathaway, Investment Case for Gold Part 2. One of the charts, which is up on the blog, it's off the homepage now, but if you scroll down to previous blog commentaries, you'll see it. The gold shorts that have been put on since the beginning of the year are extraordinary. Now, those patterns often represent a both an effort officially through the Exchange Stabilization Fund or members of the New York Fed Bank to push things one way or the other. And of course, the signal is sent to the market, particularly the hedge funds. This is where we're going to go. Carry trades and other sources finance them going there. And sure enough, you see tremendous movements that don't represent the fundamental. Where's the money going? It appears to be leaving the bond market and going into the stock market. It's certainly not going to go into commodities when they're on this downturn. We did, Chuck Gibson and I did an equity overview in January where we describe the strong case that we're in a long-term bear stock market. However, the critical question is we have piled trillions and trillions of dollars into the bond market, asset-backed securities, derivatives, all parts of the fixed income market. The question now is, if that money starts to leave, if interest rates stop falling, it's very hard to imagine how they could go even lower. God forbid they should start rising. Where's that money going to go? If it goes to the equity market, then we could literally be seeing a new paradigm for the equity market. And that's what Chuck and I are going to talk about in the April equity overview. Is it possible that instead of the long-term bear, we could see a variety of variables, but particularly the money moving out of the bond market shift us into a new paradigm? We are certainly at a very all-time high in terms of price-earning ratios. But it's a reminder what happened this week of the fundamental issue of money versus wealth. If you listen to our audio seminar on real wealth, you'll get a great description of the differences between making money and building real wealth. If you take a look at what's performing well in the equity markets, to give you an example, at the American Deposit Receipts, ADRs are the global stocks that are traded eligible to trade on the U.S. markets. If you look at performance for ADRs for the last 6 months, what's the number one best category in terms of performance? The investment banks, they're up 43%. So we're talking about another wave of financial speculation. A lot of this is not real wealth. Great post tonight from Shadow Stats. John Williams points out that when the Dow closed at 14,100 approximately in 2007, or the closing today of 14,329 is the equivalent of 12,929 in 2007. So on an inflation-adjusted basis, the Dow would have to hit 15,722 to really be on an inflation-adjusted basis at the same place at 2007. Gold, however, has more than doubled. But that's little solace to people who bought gold in the high of 2011 or been living in the consolidation since 2011. The media hawks were certainly on it, making, doing everything they could to make the primary trend in gold and silver seem in question. But so far, the consolidation looks to be within the boundaries of what's reasonable, despite all the hoopla. We're going to be talking a lot about this in depth next week with Franklin Sanders, and then again in April with Chuck on the, could a movement out of the bond market shift us into a whole new paradigm in the equity markets? It's certainly possible. But remember to look at all these things with inflation in mind. Well, as I said, the U.S. budget sequester is rolling out with lots of fear and talk and exaggeration, and the patience with Washington throughout the country is wearing thin. If you're interested in what's going on in the politics, I really encourage you to take a look at my article, Coming Clean, Beyond the Fiscal Cliff. I describe all the different systemic reasons why reengineering the budget and reengineering government in this way is extremely difficult. But for those who want the deeper story, I encourage you to take a look at it. You can link from the blog. To address the debt ceiling, which would literally shut down the federal government at the end of March, legislation now passed yesterday in the House of Representatives. A similar bill is expected to pass in the Senate. And so the debt ceiling will be pushed out until September. But I suspect that the debt ceiling and the coming up of the debt ceiling is going to be with us for quite a while. The president sat down with Paul Ryan today trying to formulate a budget plan, but the partisanship is on, and expect to see Washington very much gridlocked over partisanship this year. Part of it reflecting deep divisions and sort of multiple personality disorder within all the constituencies, including most Americans. two very good articles up on the blog this week about the oil card, including one from The Economist. One of the big issues before the administration is, will they start to permit the exportation of gas? It would be liquefied. So we've only seen one LNG plant approved. There's a tremendous arbitrage between prices in the U.S., Europe, and Asia. Of course, if you keep extremely low gas prices in the United States, it's going to be great for manufacturing. Energy is 40% of our manufacturing costs. But the impact of those decisions will have a big swing on trade deficits and manufacturing costs. And there's no doubt about it, the extraordinary development of low-cost energy and domestic supply is having a real role in keeping the U.S. dollar strong. I wanted to point out some articles from the blog. It's been quite an interesting week. The transition is on its way in the leadership in China. China is a country that has whose leadership is under tremendous pressure and has had a very difficult year. And the importance of a smooth transition there is not to be underestimated. Piece on the blog. I donated today, and a lot of times when I make a donation, I put it up on the blog to let you know and recommend it. Sheriff, it was a solicitation sent out by Sheriff Richard Mack, who's been on the Solari Report, in support of the Delaware Sheriff Christopher, who's going to court. There's been an effort by Delaware Attorney General Beau Biden to strip him of his ability to arrest. Now, that is entirely unconstitutional, but the idea that the sheriffs would be stripped of their ability and their arrest powers means that a lot of the nullification bills that are in the state Senate houses would have no effect if nobody locally has the power to arrest federal officers engaged in criminal acts. There's a real critical power issue there. So there's a post up on the blog if you're interested. Go ahead and donate. It's a very worthy cause. The Delaware Attorney General Beau Biden is Joe Biden's son, and that's why I suspect this is a very strategic lawsuit. Hugo Chavez has died. Many unanswered questions, I'm sure, as to whether that death was natural. I put up the video on the blog of the story of the time that the Americans tried to have him overthrown and succeeded for 24 hours, and then it got reversed. It's a terribly interesting story up on the blog in a video form. Stories keep coming in all week long regarding efforts to sort of militarize enforcement or have military activity on the United U.S. Within the U.S. borders. I suspect part of what is up is concern about war and making sure that the U.S. leadership is prepared to deal with being blackmailed and a pincer movement between nuclear blackmail and the financial system. But to remind us that some of these threats are real, North Korea vowed on today to launch a preemptive nuclear strike against the United States. And Russia this week carried out its biggest nuclear army drill in two decades. So a lot of posturing going on around the world. We have a report, and it's up on the blog, of the various parties organizing to take advantage of the mining effort that has been begun in Afghanistan, pointing out that there is an estimated $1 trillion of mineral wealth to be had, and it reminds you what war is really about. A great article, the Swiss voters have approved a plan to limit executive compensation of Swiss companies located in Switzerland. And very inspiring action by the Swiss people. Another article is rolled off the homepage, but I would really encourage each person to go find it. Paul Craig Roberts put a post up by an anonymous poster, very detailed analysis of Obamacare. We see reports from people at state agencies who are in charge of applying this law, giving us warnings. We see this warning of how expensive and cumbersome and difficult this is going to be to most American families. And I think to prepare for what's coming and to think about how you want to handle it, I would really encourage you to read that article. It's a real resource. It's called Obamacare Deception, and it's down in the commentary section on the blog. Lots of discussion this week about austerity issues in Europe and getting down to, in fact, the real issues. Does it make sense to just slash and cut things short term, or do we need to evolve the model? Do we need systemic change that is designed to produce real growth? And that's exactly the conversation that has to be had. They're finally getting it to Europe after they've done tremendous damage to the economy. It was going to take us a while to get to that here, but we need to do the same thing, because part of the problem is that the federal budget, both in Europe and here, represents an industrial economy, and technology and globalization means that the economy is now in a changing and different model. We need to re-engineer the federal budgets to do the same. Uh-oh, media doesn't matter. Lots of talk about what the Italian elections have meant. One story up in the blog, media doesn't matter, because in fact, when you look at the extent to which the elections in Italy were determined by social media and the blogosphere as opposed to the traditional corporate media, it's a very interesting case study on where things are going. And finally, if you want to be inspired, there's a little video about a 15-year-old who has invented a new test to detect pancreatic cancer that will only cost 3 cents. It took him about a year or 2 years to do it. And it's it's a remarkable story of what's happening when you get billions of people on the internet with access to the kind of resources or with access to each other and all of their knowledge. So, but it's very inspiring. And I will point out that it's one reason why there are tremendous deflationary pressures in the economy. Our hero tonight is somebody we're going to talk a little bit more when we talk about Let's Go to the Movies, is Sixto Rodriguez, who's an American folk musician. He's based in Detroit, Michigan, where part of the Salieri Report team is. Or they're in Upper Michigan, but they're in Michigan. His career was initially pretty short-lived. He did two albums that didn't sell very well and went back to being a construction worker. And unbeknownst to him, his work took off in South Africa, and he became the equivalent of Jimi Hendrix in South Africa without knowing it. At some point, everyone in South Africa thought he was dead. And finally, two fans decided to figure out what happened to him, and off they went. Tracked him down and in the process made a documentary film searching for Sugar Man, which has now won both the U.S. Academy Awards and the British equivalent of the Academy Awards. And I've seen it. It's quite a marvelous documentary, and it just reminds you that dreams do come true. We'll talk a little bit about it later. In Ask Catherine, we have one question. The other questions are for Eric. Did you read in Jim Woolley's newsletter, and I am a subscriber, did you read in Jim Woolley's newsletter that Mark Zuckerberg's real identity is something like Hank Greenberg and David Rockefeller's secret love grandchild? Disinfo to the max or what? I have no idea. And in fact, at some point, the next time I talk to Jim, I'll ask him. But I have no idea. What I will tell you is that the notion of something like this is a lot less bizarre than it sounds. If you're not familiar with it, it certainly does sound a little strange. But the phenomena of bloodliners is real. You see constant stories of children being placed throughout the middle class who are adopted, and they're either fathered or from sort of royal or wealthy families. In fact, patterns like this. I'll never forget being taken aside when I was in the East Hampton by somebody very important, powerful, and saying, Douglas Dillon was really adopted. Clarence Dillon and his wife were in Switzerland and picked up Douglas, and he's really not their kid, which I do believe is true. But, again, you hear these stories, and they're not as strange as they sound. Okay, so let's turn to our interview. And I just can't tell you how pleased I am. I first met Eric Hughes in the early 90s. I used to go to Esther Dyson's PC Forum. I'd run into him there. I'd run into him out in San Francisco. He was, at the time, a brilliant mathematician from Berkeley and one of the founders of Cypherpunks, and an entrepreneur. And I think, to me, one of the most knowledgeable people about financial payment systems and their relation to sort of new digital technology, and also just a very powerful intellect and a lion-hearted person. And so I got to know Eric back then, and I hadn't seen him for quite some time. And when I decided we really needed to do a Salieri report on the digital systems, I called Eric in Utah and said, okay, can I get you on the Salieri Report? And he said, yes. So With no further ado, Eric, thank you so much for joining us on the Solari Report.
Well, thank you. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. So, how in the world did you get interested in payment systems?
From privacy issues. When Tim May and I dreamed up cypherpunks in the summer of 92, before we had our first meeting, we were focused principally on two technologies at the time for anonymous communications and anonymous payments. And so I ended up focusing on payments for a lot of my cypherpunk activism. It ended up being mostly research, not a lot of fielded systems, because as I dug into it, it just kept getting deeper and deeper and deeper in terms of what you had to know in order to actually pull something off. It wasn't simply a case of being able to write code and put out code and make something happen. That's not what payment systems are, is what I learned.
Uh-huh. Tell us about cypherpunks, what it was. Tell us a little bit about the history.
Cypherpunks was really the first large internet activist movement. It got started in 1992. The Clipper chip came out in 1993, which did us endless amount of benefit in terms of promoting the cause. It was quite large, and it was prior to the World Wide Web, which got really going in 94 and 95, and before the internet had become a consumer commodity. So we got specialty attention, for the most part, in technical and business press, not so much in the overall popular press, except for some of the cryptography policy issues like Clipper. But we were focused on privacy and autonomy and all the good things about decentralized power.
Well, it's funny. I remember at the time how excited I was. If I had to define the stupidest thing I've ever said in my life, I remember turning to a very important Washington attorney after working with the technology. I think this was in 95. And I said to him, look, we just don't need the banks anymore. There are ways of doing all this without the banks. The power is going to shift to Silicon Valley and things are going to really change. Famous last words.
Yeah, that was the same year, 95, that I wrote an issue of Esther Dyson's newsletter for her on digital payments. And one of the first things I said in that episode was banking as a human activity is about 1,000 years old, and computer industry is only a few decades old. So which of those do you think is going to take over the other's business over time?
So you were betting on the banks.
It was foolhardy to believe that you could simply just write a little technology and replace banking.
Right.
Of course, you have to know what banking is about before you can say that. And basically, very few people in the technology world had any inkling of what it was really about at the time.
Well, we called tonight the non-revolution in digital payments. So why don't you talk a little bit about the development of the internet, and then what has happened in terms of the payment systems integrating in with the internet, and sort of just give us a history. Bring us from that time when you were smarter and I was naive, and bring us up to date on where we are now. What's happened, and why do you call it a non-revolution?
Well, the main reason, okay, so there's two ways of calling it a non-revolution. The weak form, which is not very interesting, is to say that we really don't have any new payment systems on the internet that weren't extensions of existing financial products, principally payment cards like Visa and the automated clearinghouse system, which moves checks around. Those two mechanisms undergird pretty much all the payment systems that are on the internet, predominantly PayPal. And there really hasn't been any, there was really no fundamental novelty in the way that those transactions were gained. What did happen is that they were simply extended out so that they could be transacted on the internet. So that's not really a revolution. It's more of an organic, incremental change to a long phenomenon of the extension of payment systems out into smaller and smaller areas, into greater, smaller volumes, sorry, smaller average transaction sizes and larger and larger volumes. So that's been going on for decades. The more interesting way in which there was no revolution is that there were, the digital cash technology was invented originally by a fellow named David Chaum, who is a true seminal figure in terms of thinking about such things. The non-revolution that didn't happen is that those transaction systems not only, well, they were tried in terms of, there was a DigiCash VC startup, but they were never fully fielded. So no one really knows how well they would have worked in practice, because in many ways they just never got off the ground. And so one non-revolution was the kind of simple non-revolution of extension of existing things, but the other one was things that might have been done that never grew, that never scaled, that were never really known on whether they would work in practice by being able to get large.
Right.
And that happened largely because there was timing, there was accidents, there were personalities involved. But largely, it's because it was cheaper overall to not have a revolution, simply to extend the incumbents outward rather than to mount all the effort to do something fundamental.
Well, it's funny, in the developed world, the systems, the incumbents, if you will, move deeper, as you said, to do more transactions at smaller and smaller amounts and smaller transaction costs. But the other things that happened is they also moved into parts of the world where they weren't. So, for example, and I put this up on the blog, one of the books you recommended I read for tonight, which I found was very useful, was The Payment System Design Management Supervision. The link will be up on the blog from the, Bruce Summers wrote it for the International Monetary Fund. It reminded me again of all the effort they were doing at that time to go into places like Russia and build out their, their stock exchange, their mortgage markets, and put them on the international payment systems. And in fact, it made it much easier to harvest those systems and harvest the assets in those places because you did. So you're taking the incumbent system and you're using it to drive outward globally and then deeper within the developed world.
Right. And a large amount of that book is quite good in terms of just knowing what that the payment system is really all about. It's much more than about adding and subtracting numbers.
Right.
But the thing you're talking about is the increased fungibility that happens as the result of taking an incumbent system and bringing the other local systems, national systems, up to snuff so that they can interoperate. Because it's not a mere matter of moving the numbers across a network from Europe to Russia, from the U.S. to Russia. It was a matter of creating a stable system in Russia that you could trust the numbers moving back, that you would get your money when the numbers
Right.
moved. And that issue of trust and how you structure trust in terms of the payment system is really the core of things. And that's not a technology issue.
Correct. Now, this is another crosscut to all of this is privacy, some of which relates to the integrity of the systems, but some of it relates to what it means to us as a user. If you look at 20 years ago, a lot more of my transactions were done with cash and a lot more were private. And now we're talking about operating through systems where, I don't know about you, but I believe the data is transparent to a variety of parties, and the system is organized that way. And so...
Well, it's certainly it's transparent by law to a number of parties,
right.
Principally the Treasury Department. Your listeners probably know about the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. It's abbreviated as FinCEN, the piece of the Treasury Department that focuses on looking at transaction records and looking for patterns. And it had just started when I started doing cypherpunks. It was fairly new then. And the things they were focused on at the time were detecting things like smurfing money through the U.S. payment systems for drug deals. So where you had a $10,000 reporting limit and they were looking for not just those payments going out directly, but ones that were adding up and getting aggregated and pointing out to it. And so these were the kind of transactions that they were analyzing 20 years ago. And we've had 20 years in the interim of increased data collection and increased analytical capacity.
Right. I told you this story. I'll never forget when I was in Washington, I had a friend who was a reporter who was lunching with one of the senior guys at the Drug Enforcement Agency. And he said to her, let's face it, honey, you know, all the wires are batched and go through the New York Fed, you know, for the whole country. So you know what they know where everything is.
Yeah, it's true. There was a change that happened in that around that same time period that in 94-95. It was, I thought, quite significant, is that they changed the federal wire transfer system from, it had used to be the case that each of the dozen Federal Reserve banks individually had run their own clearing and settlement system, and they integrated them into a single system, single technical system called Fedwire, from Fedwire to FedNet, I'm sorry. And they consolidated even that transaction system. Evidently, having 12 centers of power was too many. They needed just one.
Oh, my, that is centralized.
There was one live machine room and one hot backup that they did when they did the technology changeover.
At one point, I got very interested in who the corporate contractors were who were running the payment systems and databases for a variety of parties, including the government. And what I discovered was that if you mapped out not just the payment system, but who the information technology company was that was running the system or providing the system or doing a variety of tasks, the world looked very different if you mapped it out from the back end. So, for example, you know, I wrote a story once about one of the most important lead investors and guys on the board at Enron was also the chairman and lead investor in an IT contractor who was doing very high-level IT work for the Department of Justice and the SEC, as well as the New York Stock Exchange. And at one point I said, you know, the Department of Justice may not have asserted control of Enron's documents, but the Enron board had asserted control of the Department of Justice's documents. And so when you map out the back end of these systems, you see some pretty funny relationships. Now, that information is very hard to get. I once called the heads of the 12 New York Fed banks, and I said, what private IT companies manage or monitor or are involved in your systems? And they said, that's confidential information. You're not allowed to know. But I did try.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are both legitimate and illegitimate ways of gathering the data. But in any case, we know that the data gathering, the watching itself before analysis is extensive.
Right. Well, what these systems do is it allows you to aggregate and watch a great deal of information, not just on individuals, but on patterns. So the intelligence that can come from these systems is quite extraordinary, I think. You know, and I don't, you know, that can be both positive and negative. One of the things we saw during this period, Eric, was a tremendous effort by Treasury to get every individual in the banking system. You see certain populations that are very resistant to coming into the banking system. But of course, to make everything digital, you need that population in. So you can see a real pressure to try and to get everyone to the point where they can transact digitally. And I think that's one of the reasons why I think the movement to smartphones is such an important one, because smartphones make it possible to finally succeed at that, so that you can literally get everyone in a position where you can transact digitally, which means you can go all digital on all sorts of things, particularly those governed or managed by government.
Now, this isn't a U.S. phenomenon. In fact, in Japan, they've been doing payments by smartphones for 15-odd years now.
And really?
In most other, Oh, yeah, and in many other jurisdictions. Yeah. Not smartphones, like just like SMS messaging previously, actually.
Right. Well, Europe is very, very much ahead. I was in Holland in November, and they're very much, much more smartphones in terms of their payment transactions than we are.
No, and it's, you know, the only reason that I think that we didn't have phone payments much earlier in the U.S. is that we had the legacy of the AT&T divestiture and all of the warring camps that got that sprung up along there. There was basically no, you ended up with a kind of split the spoils between major players mentality in the telco market, which meant that they were constantly foisting incompatible technologies down their own silos. And unlike Europe, where you had a single GSM standard, you had all sorts of different technical standards in the U.S., and it delayed the onset of smartphone, of, you know, telephone payments. So
right.
that's ending, basically, because phones are going on the Internet, which is a common area, and you'll be able to just avoid that gratuitous incompatibility in the U.S. phone market. But the point is that the overall thrust to move the extent of the payment systems out to the very edges and of retail margin, you know, is going on everywhere, not just the U.S. And it's in many ways a kind of, I wouldn't say inevitable, but inexorable, certainly, kind of overall trend in the business environment.
Well, on one hand, the economics very much argue for it to happen. On the other hand, what's interesting is if you look at the economics of doing everything digital, on one hand, the transaction costs have dropped enormously. If you look at my costs as a business owner dealing with security problems and issues, you know, sort of fraudulent charges on credit cards and all the different sort of integrity issues, the expense is enormous. So that's why every time they talk about driverless cars, I think, you know, how are we going to how are you going to deal with the cost of the integrity issues? You know, so the transactions are getting much more efficient, but the sort of blowback issues, the expense is skyrocketing from my just looking, you know, at me and the entrepreneurs and businesses I know.
Yeah, there were always costs of handling cash as well. I mean,
right.
Cash expenses, just paying people to go to drive to the bank, like direct labor costs, shrinkage costs from employee and other kinds of theft.
Right.
Overall, it's been kind of there are still expenses in dealing with payment systems. They're just different expenses now. What I should point out about what you're saying is that the bulk of the benefit of the digitization of transaction systems has not been reflected in the lower cost of operation by the end users. There's been a large amount of actual wealth created in higher efficiencies, and it has not been distributed down to the customer level.
But it has made choice and convenience greater for the customer, I would say.
Oh, that's true.
And if you look at what people are choosing.
Convenience is the best coin to buy privacy with. That's been very clear for quite a number of years for me.
Right.
Is that simply making something easy to do, people will gladly give up their privacy. I mean, I made a remark. Again, this is another 20-year-old remark, but that the cost of privacy was not greater than 3% of the transaction volume of whatever you were buying. People were willing to, you know, pay a little extra. This was back before they disallowed this, but people were willing to pay a little extra to pay with their credit card and willing to give up their privacy in return. So you know that whatever the effective interchange cost for people's perceived privacy, it's not very high. Now, admittedly, we haven't had a kind of major privacy disaster that would cause that perceived value to change. But, you know, paying for lack of buying people's personal data by offering them convenience has been a very, you know, Google's
right.
business model in so many ways.
One of the things I thought that was most interesting that I heard you say recently was when we were talking is that if you study money histories, and I also want to mention, because I put this up on the link, you also had recommended The History of Money from AD 800. If you look at the questions, you know, you can have all the new technology in the world, but everything comes back to the basic questions of how humans are going to relate to each other and what constitute trust between people when it comes to transactions. And technology doesn't change any of that. It always brings us back to the basics. We have to go back to the basics, particularly if we're going to try and do something new. And
let's go back to 800 AD, because that was the invention of pound sterling by Charlemagne, right? And one of the great inventions of Charlemagne was standardized coinage. And this is not a technology of minting coins in a more precise way than they had done before. And the trust at issue is that you are trusting the person operating the mint to make sure that there's the same amount of silver in that coin for every coin, so that the coin has good value. So even something as seemingly intuitive as using precious metals for money still have these issues of trust. You just can't get away with them. And as soon as you intermediate anything over physical possession of minted coins, be it paper money or an electronic record, book record system, you just have all that many more issues of trust. I mean, it really is foundational.
Right. Right. Well, if you were listening to this Solari report and you wanted to learn more to understand the digital systems in your life, how would you go about doing it? What would you do?
Oh, well, I can tell you what I did, because I was in this previously. I hit the books, and in the books for me, I was living in Berkeley, California at the time, where I'd gone to school, and I headed off to campus, and I found the business library, and I sat in the business library and read. And I was, you know, then as now, I did contract software for a living, and so I would simply take off a couple afternoons a week and head over to the library and spend the afternoon there. And so I was reading things like American Banker, the trade publication of the American Banking Association. And I was reading, you know, books on, technical books on clearing and settlement systems and mostly money, some amount of commodities and stock clearing and settlement. I was reading law books on, in fact, I bought a thick copy of a law, book called The Law of Electronic Payment Systems. To understand what was going on underneath the hood there. And this was all in order to understand how the technology actually worked.
Right.
So the technology works by behaving, but it's people's interpretation of what the technology is doing is where the action is in terms of money. So you need to understand, you know, to get a full sense of all this stuff, you need to understand what it is. Now, I can't recommend that to everybody, simply because I had some very highly technical issues that I was trying to figure out in terms of the nitty-gritty of building a payment system from scratch. In terms of what people can go do to learn, I will recommend that anybody that really wants to understand what the payment system is all about is to obtain a copy. It's not all that expensive. That book on the payment systems that was done by the IMF that I recommend to you that you'd already mentioned. It's an excellent
book. Yeah, it's up on the blog.
It's an excellent book that really describes what's going on. And that's the payment systems for just money transfers between banks. There's other kinds of payment systems like the Visa clearing system that moves credit card payments around. It's different in details, but all of the principles that are true for cash payments between banks are true about Visa as well. You have some slightly different issues on who takes consumer credit risk and where the different failures are allocated, but those are differences at the margins, really. The basics are still all the same. There's always a club at the center of large players who band together to cooperate, and they always sell their services to their customers and act as a group intermediary. I mean, that's the overall structure of how any of these work. And you have to understand what the trust relationships are amongst the club members to really know what's happening.
Right. And to me, I think some of the most dangerous moments in the financial system is when there's a real seize up and problem and a breakdown in trust. you know, enter between some of those systems.
That was the fall of 2008.
Right.
That was primarily, basically every time there's, a credit crisis says that I don't trust you to pay me again like I did yesterday. That's the down-to-earth translation of what that highfalutin term actually means. It says, I don't think you're going to give me my money back, so I'm not dealing with you anymore.
Right. Now, let's talk a little bit about wallets. What are wallets, and what do you think is going to happen in terms of movement of the system down into the smartphone and the use of wallets?
You mean you're not talking about leather billfolds that I carry my actual...
No, I'm talking about digital wallets.
It's a piece of the technology. It's just the place you store stuff. They're almost all virtual, meaning pieces of software. The only successful wallets I know have been telephone-based wallets. In terms of... When I say successful, I'm talking about large... double-digit penetration into the consumer market, not experimental systems that you can make function. But the wallets that have worked in the past have all been based on telephones. And the reason for that has been largely that it's a captive platform that hasn't really been easy to hack. So I suspect that the rollout of wallets is going to not proceed as rapidly as people would like because of security issues with the platforms that are running on. And they will probably end up not being on anything you actually own, but will be a record in some hosted software in some machine room that you gain access to with your technology device. So they'll use the phone only to authenticate you. And they won't even use it at all to store anything, actually. The actual storage will be up in the cloud.
Right.
So mostly wallet is going to turn out to be a misnomer because there's nothing actually in there.
Right. It's not going to be a wallet. It's going to be a deposit.
It's going to be a demand deposit account at something that's de facto a bank, whether or not it's regulated exactly like a bank or not. So,
well, tell me if you're.
I guess the very shortest version of the answer to that question is wallets don't really exist, and they won't, and they're unlikely to behave that way.
Right. So bring me up to. You sent me a very interesting article that is also up on the blog. You've populated the blog this week, Eric, about internet activism and the cypherpunks are still at it. So bring us up to date on what's happening in terms of the debate about how the internet's going to be governed and what that means to payment systems.
Well, let me just first make a disclaimer that I'm not really up to speed on everything that's happening with internet activism anymore because I don't really do it in the same way I did before. Having said that, what's very clear in all the internet activism there is, and there's a goodly amount of it still, none of it has to do with the payment system. With one exception, which is Bitcoin, which we can talk about later, but I will just give you my summary version. Bitcoin is not the answer. We'll just do it later. The places where I'm hearing things talk about, the governance of the internet are really in some sense back to foundational issues.
Mm-hmm.
Things that we thought we had won back in the 90s. Things like your internet connection may not be cut off, for random and arbitrary reasons. So like the SOAP and TIPA bills that were killed both had that property. But, there's a non-legislative version of this coming out now about Comcast and some other major people that are dually embedded in both content and distribution are going to start sending out warnings to their users when they think they're doing something wrong. And so we're in a situation where there might be private action with no judicial review or no prior judicial review for people being just disconnected at the internet for undesirable behavior. So that's a worse situation than we were facing in the 90s. feel free to be wary about government power all you want, but arbitrary private action by service providers is a worse threat. It's harder to argue a public policy issue when you've got private players. At least in the American mindset, it's easier in Europe.
Right.
So this last week, there was a thing called the Freedom to Connect conference that I was listening to the coverage about, which is on that topic. So, we're getting to a, what seems to be is that there were these initial battles that were fought in the 90s over many of these issues. And now the money is really on the table. And a lot of stuff is going to get figured out that'll be persistent for decades to come in terms of policy.
Right.
So.
Well, I think to me, a lot of it comes down in the financial area, a lot of it comes down to privacy. Am I allowed to communicate through the internet, or am I allowed to transact with another party in a manner which is private? And so a lot of the activism revolves around privacy, but privacy turns around and impacts everything, not just transactions or payment systems. There's a lot that people can do to organize, to engage in payments or engage in transactions. If they have privacy, they can proceed to do that organization, which fundamentally changes the way that they can interact and shifts economic power to them, if they can organize in those ways. But it takes privacy. And without privacy...
And technically speaking, privacy is not under direct restriction. Privacy itself is not under direct attack like it was back when. Like, for example, the Clipper chip, which was wiretap-enabled cryptography, was a direct attack on privacy.
Right.
I mean, the strategy they had was to make sure that was the kind of encryption that everyone used, so there would be no possibility for privacy. That's not really where the threats to privacy come from anymore. In terms of privacy, I'm going to make one brag about how good SOC 2 was.
Go for it.
When the Patriot Act was drafted, there were no cryptography restrictions in place. They didn't have to be argued out. They were just never written down to begin with. And it was pretty much the only thing that did not lose in privacy to the Patriot Act in some ways. And we did that by arguing the case broadly from a number of political things, by enrolling allies and doing a bunch of ground-type politics to change the policy perception about the value of cryptography in terms of preservation of privacy, that it wasn't even conceivable to try to squish it when the Patriot Act came along. And I should remind people that only 4 and 5 years earlier were the last gasps of the Clipper chip. There was Clipper in 93, and then there was 5 years of weaker and weaker legislative attempts to try to get something on that order passed.
Right.
So 97 was the last of them. And just 4 years later, the Patriot Act passed, but we had won so completely that it was inconceivable to do otherwise. And so that's the level of success you can have if you make your case in a principled fashion and do your homework and actually put the effort in. So,
right.
I want to inspire people, at least with that success story, that this is not utterly hopeless, that we did have one major victory that makes the possibility of privacy yet retained. Now, switching to the other side of things, the main threats to privacy now are coming from, roughly, Facebook and Google and their ilk, which is
right.
To say... Software,
not government.
That you don't buy,
right.
Software that you don't buy with cash, you pay for with your privacy. And your privacy is eliminated. It is sent through the blender and sold to commercial interests trying to sell you things. In the most beneficent interpretation of how that data shifts. We don't know in many ways the data is actually being used. I'm not personally.
So I think it's fair to say you don't have a Facebook page and I don't have a Facebook page. Is that correct?
I do not have a Facebook page. That is correct.
Neither do I.
I don't even have a I do not even have a pseudonymous Facebook page for trolling people on Facebook.
Uh-huh.
So I completely refuse to participate. So, I mean, basically what happened in the mid-90s is that the Action basically went out of personal computer software and moved into internet software. And so you can mark that transition as roughly 95, 96. So for 17 odd years, we've been living in the neo-mainframe world, where we have hosted applications on other people's machines with no control over our own data. We are granted access to our data because it's commercially useful for people to keep giving us our data. But all these service agreements say that your data could disappear at any time.
They right.
have no obligation to return it to you. So it's not just privacy that's been diminished. It's autonomy more generally.
Right.
We become subjects to the machines in the cloud who are doing things, and the ability to do things for yourself and therefore have autonomy over the devices that you own is greatly diminished.
So let me ask you, Eric.
One second, not as a technical possibility. It's still possible to build those things. It's just that the disparity in the number of people who want to use one model over the other has created a huge economic disincentive for people to innovate in terms of autonomy and privacy and freedom for end-user devices.
So if I'm listening to this and I want to support groups that are trying to protect individual rights on the internet, if I want to support some internet activists, what do I do? How do I do that?
Well, unfortunately, I can't just give you the address of the foundation that's supporting that kind of software that you can donate to. To my knowledge,
okay.
No such organization exists as yet.
Okay.
The EFF is a good place to start looking for people involved.
Right.
Because the EFF still ends up being the cluster around which a lot of these things orbit. But the
right.
EFF it was not always this way, but it has become a lawsuit machine in the same way that the ACLU is a lawsuit machine.
Right.
They do decent work working the judicial system to make sure that the worst things are turned back, but they don't actually move things forward a lot. Now, there is one thing that I can recommend that is promising in this regard. I've forgotten the name. The name has slipped my tongue. But there was there's a recent effort that I just heard about on Democracy Now! This week about an organization that sprung up to do proxy donations for WikiLeaks and other internet activists. So go find
out. Oh, that's wonderful.
We'll get it on your blog.
Okay.
But you know, the people, they're endorsing good people who are doing good work. And the easiest way, you know, to do something good now is just to go learn about those people and to tell your friends about them.
Right.
I mean, simply put, we're back in the, having been to school at Berkeley, I kind of cringe at this phrase, but it's true. We need consciousness raising in the public about the value of privacy and autonomy on the internet.
Right.
And, you know, it's not that people are ill-equipped to understand this. I mean, SOAP and PIPA got stopped dead by a mass movement once people understood. But there's really, but you know, one of the very next things to do is there needs to be larger interest in it that will eventually be able to turn into kind of non-profit donation stream to fund good projects. I mean,
right.
Software needs to get written, and the people who write the software have to live while they're doing it. So the shortest path to improving things at the end of the day is going to end up being foundation-funded software development. But there's not much of that happening right now. A lot of it,
right.
Most of the open source world is still running on volunteers.
Right, and I must admit, what's been accomplished by volunteers is extraordinary.
It is. But it has also been insufficient to turn back Google and Facebook.
Sure.
So
trillions of dollars can buy a lot.
That's absolutely true.
Okay, so before we close, we have to talk about Bitcoin.
We do have to talk about Bitcoin.
We have to. Why don't you just briefly describe what Bitcoin is, and then I'll rant about why I strongly recommend against anybody using Bitcoin.
Okay, so Bitcoin is described as a currency, which it is not. It is most accurately described as a synthetic commodity, meaning that there is a set number, set amount of Bitcoins in the world at any given time. There's an algorithm for increasing their number over time, and there's an allocation of who has power to control the resource at any given time. So there's a transaction system attached to the commodity. But to use it as money is saying too much. People have to accept it as money in order for it to be money. So there's still the issue of the trust in the system to do all over again. Now, Bitcoin is, it should be said, still, it's been used, so it's basically out of its purely experimental phase. There haven't been any obvious attacks on it yet, so it's survived its child crib death phase of deployment. But it's still very young. And if you're going to try to take down a system that you know its weaknesses for, you want to wait until it's a little larger so that people get the message. Now, having looked at the technology a bit, and I cannot say I'm a Bitcoin technical expert, it appears to me that there are several kinds of not purely technological attacks on Bitcoin that could be mounted that would cause it to go through a panic. So,
the price is varied tremendously. So, as you said, it's a commodity. So we see the price, for example, recently skyrocketing. So this is something you could lose a great deal of money on. I mean, anything is something, any commodity is that way, but
unlike a physical commodity, Bitcoin has additional risks. At some point, the cryptography will break. They might figure out a way of doing technological upgrades on it, but right now, the underlying things have a limited lifetime versus Moore's law, like all cryptography does. And the theory behind cryptography is not so solid that you don't know about a theoretical attack coming out of left field. There's a number of ways in which the system could just crash all at once. And what happens in this crash is that you are left with your bitcoins, but you're not left with anybody that's willing to trust their value to accept them as payment. So just like wildcat banknotes that were prevalent in the period of bank panics in the U.S. history and from the Civil War to World War I, the same thing is kind of scheduled for Bitcoin almost.
Right. It's kind of like a sovereign credit that has no military to back it up.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. That's exactly
right.
Perfect analogy, actually.
Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, please do not use Bitcoin. It seems like it first strikes a lot of people as sort of an independent, out of control, freedom fighting alternative. But for something to be that, it's got to have the ability to go the distance, and I don't think Bitcoin does. I couldn't agree with you more. So thank you, Eric. Okay, well, before we close, we do have one question, and I wanted to came in on the webinar software. I found the TED Talk by, and this is someone I don't know, Miko, HYPONNEN. Is that someone you know?
Yeah, I've heard the name.
To be a good primer as to the actors and motives as to the types of online activities that threaten privacy and deter online commerce, it presents certain key concepts in a non-overly technical way with valid current examples. Any comment?
Sounds like a good reference.
Okay.
I mean, some of the strongest privacy-oriented people in the world are Finnish. That fellow's Finnish. I do remember that.
Why doesn't that doesn't say, if you had to live next to the Russians in a very cold country?
They fought the Winter War in 1942. I mean, don't discount the Finns wanting their autonomy.
Oh, they're amazing people. Amazing and very, very intelligent.
But there's quite a cryptography and privacy community in Finland. And it actually doesn't surprise me that there's a that kind of talk is going to come.
Ah, okay. Well, Eric, but I can't thank you enough. You go.
Okay,
go.
We're ending. You're going to thank me, and we'll be done.
Well, I'm going to thank you, but I'm also going to ask you if there's anything else you'd like to say before we close.
Let's talk about one last thing, I think, which is important when we're talking about the payment system.
Okay.
Which we kind of touched on earlier, because you're asking about what to do next. So at risk of going over too long, I want to raise the issue of fungibility. So
okay.
One of the fungibility means that you can move something from one part of the economy to another part of the economy easily with minimal transaction costs. That's kind of what the definition is. It's basically fluid assets. So one of the general principles of fighting this kind of regime is to get rid of fungibility. Get rid of the kind of fungibility that's globalizing and universalizing. That doesn't mean that you don't have the ability to transact. It just means that your transactions with people close to you, say, are going to be different than the transactions far away from you, like your mail order companies and your telephone providers, which are large faceless corporations. So organizing at the local level to figure out what you might do in terms of creating local economies and to create the trust in local economy seems to be one of the things that I keep coming across over and over as a generic part of an actual solution to come. So we don't have time to go into that, perhaps another night.
Well, I agree, because what you see when you look at both currency transactions and credit and equity at a local level is there is a real need for vehicles that optimize within a place-based context that are different than what you need to optimize globally. And so if you want to optimize, you need a relational optimization, both local and global, and it calls for local systems. And the struggle, I mean, if you look at what I was working on in the 90s and what you were working on, was something that would allow those kind of things to happen. And the struggle has been a real tussle between the people who've wanted to consolidate and create efficiency centrally versus those who'd like to sort of allow the financial system to optimize with the echo, you know, with the environmental ecosystem and do place-based things, you know, that are more or less independent so that the local system can optimize with privacy relative to the global system. And that's been a major political struggle.
Yep, absolutely.
And we didn't talk about it because it's not a payment system, but at the heart of that struggle in the U.S. is the MERS system, which is a way of trying to make all the local real estate something that can be globalized and made non-transparent to the local system so they can't see their own real estate fly around. It's quite remarkable. It's kind of like the reverse of what we're proposing.
Yeah,
anyway.
I'll share one last anecdote because it's very telling. But I had a conversation in, I think, calendar year 99, with a senior technologist at Fannie Mae who was bragging about how good their real estate database was getting. And he was saying, I just want people to know how long this was in coming. This was 98, 10 years before the big crash. He said that, you know, we're getting so good that soon we're going to be able to just start backing loans without doing appraisals at all.
He was right. It was very soon.
It was extraordinarily soon.
Yeah, it was very soon.
So, you know, local knowledge is going to be key. Now, and one last thing on locality, all the lessons in that payment systems book that I recommended are also true at the local level.
Yes.
You're still going to need a club, and you're still going to need to develop mutual trust in that same way. The difference is not in the mechanisms that you use to move the value around. The difference is going to be what the political and social goals are of those local organizations vis-a-vis multinational finance industry.
Right. How do you hold How do you create and then hold trust through time? And that's a human question. It's not a financial question. It's not a technological question.
Trust is the foundation of money, more than any other thing. It exists in human emotion, primarily. And if you and you're going to get an argument, I get an immediate argument about people will say, well, gold is money. And I will say, no, gold is not always money. And I have an example, finally. I didn't have this back when, but I knew that gold was a social, the value of gold was a social construct. There's a book whose author I've forgotten, but his title is The Red Gold of Africa, which is about the Gold Coast region of Africa. And the reason it's called the Gold Coast is that the natives, Native Africans there, didn't value gold as money, and so it was still sitting in the hills waiting to be mined. Their high metal was copper. Their whole economy was based on copper. Copper jewelry was the high copper. Copper bangles were the socially visible form of wealth accumulation. It was an entire economy running on copper and not on gold. So even there, you have to have trust in the social convention of what other people are going to find valuable. You can't get away from it, even for something as seemingly transparent as precious metal.
Well, I would say that gold is money, but it's because you have such a large critical mass of people who believe it's money. In other words, it's the there's
that
a consensus.
That's the only reason it's money. Let's be clear.
Right.
That's the only reason it's money.
Right. But that is, you know, there are two reasons something is money. One is there's a navy who can make you agree to it. Force, and the other is a consensus. And it's always fascinating to me to see what can create a very significant consensus, something that can take something from the status of a Bitcoin to something that really is money.
Mm-hmm. And this was the third book. This is we're into the topic of the third book I recommended for this time.
Which is
a book called The Refiner's Fire, which is on the magical history of Mormonism, but it particularly pays attention to these kinds of magical creation of value in people's minds from a religious point of view. So
we will add that to the blog.
It's not specifically on money, but it's very informative as to the interior emotional life of how money is actually created. And after it's created, at the moment of creation, it's somehow pulsating and glowing still. And then it becomes routinized and it becomes something mundane. But money is never that way at the beginning.
Yeah, it's part of a sacred covenant.
That's absolutely right.
Right, it has to be.
I mean, when you're talking about value, economic value could be considered as a fraction of someone's life. And in that sense, to take their money is stealing a piece of their life and giving them nothing.
You're converting your time and your energy into something and then hoping you can convert it back. So you're right, it's your life energy.
So it's a miniature form of death, miniature form of killing. To economically abuse someone in that way.
If you use it to harvest, but if you use it to transfer your energy through time,
it changes its valence utterly, and it becomes something affirmative and convivial.
Right. Right. See, I always think of it as something wonderful. I keep, you know, it's taken me my whole life to keep mastering the fraudulent and ugly sides of it, but it doesn't have to be that way. Anyway, Eric, you know I'm going to have you back on the Salary Report, so that's the last thing I have to do is get a commitment from you that I can get you back.
Okay.
Anyway, thank you for joining us on the Salary Report. It is always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Catherine.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, coming up next week, we have a Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders. We're going to be joined by Edwin Vieira. He has now finished his incredible legal treatise, Sword and Sovereignty, on the laws related, constitutional laws related to militia. Very interesting, because one of the most important questions about organizing locally and doing the kind of things that Eric and I were just talking about locally is, what's your legal construct and how does it fit under the certainly in North America, under the Constitution. Then March 21st, we're going to be talking about starting a Solari Circle investment club with Paul Ferguson, former treasurer of the first ever Solari Circle, with me. And then March 28th, I'm going to join John Rappaport again for our discussion, Exit from the Matrix. John's pulled together a new Matrix Reveal product, and it's going to be another one of these great talks. So until next week with Franklin, a great deal to talk about what's going on in precious metals and the financial market. So until then, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you definitely need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.